Hello, Amherst community. This is Judy Frank. I teach English and creative writing at Amherst, and I'm sitting here with Amity Gage, our visiting writer. Amity is the author of three novels, Oh My Darling, The Folded World, and now Schroeder, which she's going to talk to us about today. Hello, Amity.
Hi, Judy.
First of all, congratulations on the success of this book. It must have taken even you by surprise, I think. I think very few of us set out to write a book and imagined the kind of success that it's had so far. So congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
So I'm just going to ask some questions about just nerdy craft questions, and then some questions maybe about parenthood and about bringing this book into the marketplace.
Sure.
If that's okay.
Sounds great.
So first, a first-person book. All right. Can you talk about some of the challenges for you of writing in first person?
Sure. This was my first person book. And until I heard Eric's voice, Eric is the name of my protagonist, I never thought I would really write in first person. It can be a very limiting point of view because you only get the one consciousness through the book, and that consciousness has to be interesting enough to bear the whole book. And I really felt that hearing Eric's voice was important because it was, in a sense, something that felt, after I heard him, somewhat channeled, you know. I don't want to get too mystical about it, but it did, as you know, writers, sometimes they say they hear the voice, you know. I felt that. Once I had that voice, it was easier to write it than I had thought. So I think I was waiting for a first-person voice to come to me. It is an unreliable perspective, mostly because I think that every first-person voice is unreliable in its limitations. But I do play with that concept of an unreliable narrator. And I ask the reader to collude with me in some ways in interpreting what Eric says and seeing around him. Because, of course, he's offering self-justifications and he's highlighting things and downplaying certain things in his own effort to come off a certain way. So we have to see around him. And that was a challenge for me as a writer, but it was also fun. I noticed that when I abandoned all pretense that he would be reliable and objective and honest and earnest, then I just had fun with the different layers of interpretation.
Mm-hmm. You teach a course at Amherst called Unreliabilities, and I was wondering what you've learned through that course that helped you write Schroeder or what might have inspired you.
I've learned a lot. I was attracted to the unreliable narrator before I started teaching unreliabilities. Then unreliabilities helped me try to articulate the different aspects of an unreliable narration and why it's an interesting sort of special child of, you know, literature. I think that the texts that I've taught in unreliabilities, since I've taught them several times, they have found their influence. They trickled into the book. So, for example, I teach The Good Soldier by Ford Madox Ford. And that book has a narrator who, like Eric, is at times sweet, at times hysterical, at times very honest, at times dishonest. And I think I've learned a lot from studying that one over and over. There's a part in Unreliabilities where I ask the students to go find a story with an unreliable narrator. And they've brought to my attention stories I hadn't studied before. So, for example, in class just last week, someone brought in a story by Mark Twain called Eve's Diary. And I had never read this before. It's from the point of view of Eve, as in Adam and Eve. And she's an incredibly complex, innocent, you know, naive, you know, a sort of complicated narrator I'd never found before. And so I've gotten a lot from having the students bring those things to my, mm-hmm. I've learned a lot teaching the course.
I also, first person, I've never written in first person also and worry about its limitations. I really admired this a lot. You know, I tell my students, for example, you can't you know, say, I looked at my Rolex watch. whereas in third person, you just can't give that detail. It doesn't sound right, right?
Right.
Whereas in third person, if you wanted to say you that your character was wearing it, you know, you can do that.
Yeah.
That there's a lot of just information that just sounds like you're pouring out information if you give it through first person.
Right, right.
Yeah. And I think students tend towards wanting to write in first person and thinking that's going to be more natural for them.
Yeah.
It never has seemed more natural to me.
Well, it's true. I got a word from some other writer. I don't remember whom, but it was the word inflection. And when I teach first person, either in the literature course or in the novel course or fiction writing course, I teach this concept of inflecting the first person voice. And it's fun. It's like a way of making that voice sound voiced, so that you would know how to read it. It has a personality, you know, it has texture. And I think that a lot of students think the first person voice is supposed to be sort of straightforward, but really it's much more fun if it's inflected, you know, in whatever way, based on your region, your dialect, your history, your ethnicity. And so all of those things influence inflection. Mm-hmm.
Can you teach me how to do that?
No problem. 10 yeah. minutes.
All right, we have a date. That'd be great. What made you decide to write it as a document that he's writing? What did you feel that gave you that just writing it in first person wouldn't? He says at one point, I've got a legal obligation to humanize myself, which I think is great.
You know, the truth is that might just be literary influence. And reviews have mentioned it's a jailhouse confession, you know, as if it's a genre that I wasn't fully aware of entering, you know. there are reasons for that. But I would cite a book, one book that influenced the written nature of this book was probably Pale Fire by Nabokov. That is an explication. The text of that novel is an explication of a poem that's fake that Nabokov wrote but ascribed to a character in the novel. And I love that book. I love the way, the metafictional way that you can play with a written document. So in Schroeder, there are footnotes, for example. And I really enjoyed having Eric be speaking, writing, really, and then have an opportunity for him to create a footnote as if it were a real document. There's a point in which he also poses a questionnaire. There's a little questionnaire, and he says, send your answers to prison, you know, where he is, which someone could really do. I'm actually waiting for some reader to send the response to the questionnaire to the Albany County Correctional Institution. But various things like that, that were pleasant for me to play with, and I couldn't have done without this being a written document. Right. Because usually the convention is, you're right, it's the convention is, this is being spoken in a way to the universal you, to some invisible reader. But that leaves out so many interesting things to play with.
So. I also heard a little bit of Jennifer Egan, a little bit of David Foster Wallace in the footnotes.
Well, certainly, I don't think you can write footnotes these days without calling him to mind, and I feel like he owns the footnote.
Yeah, he does
and
the
you know, he's huge. He owns the footnote. Let's admit it.
Yeah.
But I actually started with these footnotes being endnotes, and I think it was my own way of trying to escape his not so much influence, but his ghost, his footprint. So they were endnotes. And then the feedback I got, I submitted the manuscript with the footnotes as endnotes. And then the feedback I got from my publisher and other readers in his house was that no one's going to stop reading the text and flip pages and read the endnotes and flip back. It's just distracting and irritating. And so I changed them to the bottom of the page. And I also got rid of some of them. And I shoved them into the primary text and in moments where that was the more important choice rather than this play that I was doing, this playfulness. It was more important that there be a more kind of solid place for them in the text.
I can see that. I mean, I can see the temptation for the footnote, just the excess, right? The extra. And another thing I just thought of, by the way.
They can be endless.
And they can be endless.
I want to say that my intention with them was play and also layers and texture. But also, I wanted the footnotes to have their own narrative. And this is something I hope is successful. I'm not sure. It's up to a reader to determine. But Eric starts his footnotes, they're very academic and pretentious, and then as the story goes on, they become more personal, and sometimes like anti-footnotes, you know, random things that don't really need to be a footnote. And then finally, stories of his German childhood. And it was important to me that that they had that second parallel narrative. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. What brought the story to your mind? What prompted it? Where did it come from?
There's so many influences, and they just when I talk about it, I realize how many more there were than I was aware of.
Yeah.
But I would say some primary influences, they're personal. My coming into my own as a parent, my transition from being a person who took care of only herself to a person who took care of someone else and who was trying to do the right thing by this new, very alert consciousness that I had brought into the world, trying to say and do the right thing by him, my son. I started this book when he was 3, and that was just when he was starting to speak and observe and make points that were a little too close to home. So I was curious about how I was doing, I think, on one level. And then also there were other personal factors. My parents' very late stage separation. My father's then, soon after that, my father's illness. His passing. And then also thrown into this mix, many other things. There's my mother's own immigrant story, mm-hmm. which I threw into here too. My mother's an immigrant from Latvia, not German, we're not German. And then the final influence and the thing that really sparked probably the narrative was a knowledge of the Clark Rockefeller story, and he's this guy who a lot of people have heard of by now, but when I read about him in 2008, I didn't realize it would be such a known story. But Clark Rockefeller was a con man and a fraud, a guy who said he was a Rockefeller, but he was some German immigrant. There were some crucial things I borrowed, like immigrant, you know, iconic American name, mm-hmm. divorce. And I took those and I left the rest. You know, it's not a novelization of that story. Mm-hmm. But I really did need that spark of, okay, this is kind of dovetailing with some of my own themes that I was kind of at work at already. And this guy, you know, kind of made the, sparked a larger idea for me.
It's interesting that as you were thinking about your own, you're being a mother, is that you decide to write about a father. That's mm-hmm. an interesting piece of it. I was going to ask you to read a passage. It's one of the things that I really love about this book is that it's such a great book about parenthood, and I think mm-hmm. probably about fatherhood as mm-hmm. well, that mm-hmm. he so walks the border between being a really excellent dad and he's, you know, his being present, the way he just turns the laser beam of his attention onto this child, being an excellent father and being a pathological father, right? Both of those things. And what I love about that is that it shows that parenthood is really always about walking that line between being great at it and being terrible at it.
That's right.
And so I was wondering, the passage that I like so much is it's where he's just lost, the recession has hit. He has lost his job as a realtor, and he's going to now be the stay-at-home dad for his daughter Meadow for a little while. So if you wouldn't mind reading the beginning.
Of course. Do I remember my first days alone with Meadow? I sure do. I remember looking down at her, her thumb snug in her mouth, her stinky blanket under the other arm, and me filled with complete terror. The neighborhood was silent as a tomb. The leaves on the oak trees were still. An acorn pinged off the hood of a car. I could hear my own blood in my ears. I waited for someone to approach down the street, anyone. I longed to make the sort of meaningless small talk I was so good at. How would we fill a day, two people with such different sense of fun? I felt overwhelming pressure to do something outrageous or entertaining. I worried that she would just pick up Stinky Blanket and walk away from me. What I didn't know was that she was helplessly bound to me already. It was me who could have wandered away from her. I could have left her outside the fire station and walked away and, after a year or two of effortful self-justification, would barely have thought of her again. My daughter stood barely looking at me, as if embarrassed by her position, the ligature of her polka-dotted underpants visible above the elastic of her corduroy rompers. My heart flipped. How abandonable a child is. With this vague gleaning of one another's vulnerabilities, we were off.
Thank you. How would we fill a day, two people with such a different sense of fun? I thought it was the understatement of the century. The fantastic line. I really loved that.
You relate to that.
Yeah, I can relate to that, yes. Also the way that they're just, it just gets to the way that you're even bound to a child, that he could walk away and after, a year or two of effortful self-justification, not think of her again. Mm-hmm. Somebody who's new in your life. Mm-hmm. How parenting veers between that on the one hand and this incredible bond on the other hand, I thought was really, I hadn't heard that expressed like that before, and I really loved that. Mm.
Thank you.
There's also later, there's this moment where that afternoon I was every kind of monster, mm-hmm. Where he plays mm-hmm. very creatively all different kinds of monsters for her. Mm-hmm. Also, monster as fun, monster as he is kind of a monster. I thought that was terrific as well. Mm-hmm. I've told you this before, but this to me sounds like a really wonderful companion piece to Emma Donoghue's novel, Room. Mm. Room is a novel about a woman who's been kidnapped and had her child for years, had her child in this tiny room, and it's a tour de force as well. It's really great. And Room is the space of motherhood in a sense that it's claustrophobic. Mm-hmm. She's still nursing when he's five. Mm-hmm. She is his entire world, mm-hmm. And that kind of responsibility. Mm-hmm. Here, the version that's about fatherhood mm-hmm. is he kidnaps the child and goes on the road, mm-hmm. right? That's mm-hmm. the male, it's as though that's the fatherhood version mm-hmm. Of parenthood. Mm-hmm. And you know, she is repeatedly raped. He flirts with women and has sex, right? Mm-hmm. Though that's the difference. So the fact that they're both about kidnapping mm-hmm. is kind of amazing, that they're these sort of essential novels about parenting, mm-hmm. and they're about kidnapping. Mm-hmm. One about being kidnapped, the other about kidnapping. Mm-hmm. So I love these two together. Mm-hmm. And when we talked, you had not thought about Room as you were writing, you mm-hmm. said, but you have...
I really admire the book. I mean, like you, I just think it's fabulous.
Yeah.
And there's something about that book. It goes to a place that is uncomfortable, mm-hmm. which is, aside from just the difficulty of reading about her abuse, mm-hmm. I'm talking about what's uncomfortable is that sense of the almost claustrophobic, I think, was that your word, relationship, and the way there's no other in that room, there's no other air, and there's no other influence.
That's right.
Other than, so it's taking to an extreme degree mm-hmm. the mother-child bond as it really is, or really could be,
That's right?
If we don't allow our child some space, if we don't allow
ourselves some space.
Ourselves some space or any other influence.
Right.
I think that what I would share with her in terms of theme, if I had to look hard, would be I do feel that childhood is a very, it's a very emotionally precarious place for the child to love the parent and need the parent. And I have a lot of sympathy for that. Mm-hmm. So I put Meadow into Eric's hands, and I hope that I show her position and what it might feel like to be her, even though we don't go into her mind. Mm-hmm. We see her love for him. We also see her gradually kind of fall apart and her hair get, first of all, wild and blonde and also just dirty And then sick. Then when there's sort of we see the consequences of his actions upon her. So I have a lot of sympathy for that state mm-hmm. of that childhood vulnerability. There's one line that that Meadow says to Eric at one point, "You're my home." And this is actually a line that my son said to me once. Mm-hmm. And while it was beautiful on the one hand, it took me days to figure out what he was trying to say and how that might feel to him. Mm-hmm. I give that line to Meadow at mm-hmm. a certain critical juncture. Mm-hmm. So I feel the thematic resonance, and I'm flattered by that comparison, definitely. I know that he's a father, and I see the way he has, especially when you contrast it to Room, so much more agency, more freedom, and more confidence and irresponsibility than the protagonist, the mother in Room, can have. But I do relate to him as a parent the way you're saying the scene that you asked me to read from, you could identify with those feelings. I very much identify with his feelings, even though he's not the same gender as I am, mm-hmm. that I felt a lot of those things myself. Sure. There's a very painful love that you feel for your child. It's almost like you love them too much. And this is a universal, I think, that a mother can feel this, and I think a father can feel this. And one thing I think that is changing a bit with parenting that was definitely different from my parents' generation was that there are stay-at-home fathers mm-hmm. and stay-at-home whomevers. And whoever is responsible for the child is the one is building this daily bond with them and who's learning intimately who they are and who's starting to care about their successes and failures. And I think that could be a mother, a father, could mm-hmm. be a grandparent. Sure. So I think there's universals in there.
Sure. What were some of your biggest challenges writing this? Like, did you get stuck at any point?
You know, I didn't, which blows my mind, considering that's a unique experience
indeed.
For me. I chiseled away at my first novel for 7 years, and this one was written really in a year and a half. When I look back at my notes, I mean, I had the idea, then waited a while, then wrote it quickly. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? And I needed to get all those influences in a line before I could write it. So the challenges as I wrote it were the challenges of life, how to get the time from the family. I both needed the family as inspiration.
Material.
As material. And I also needed to get away from the family for the solitary aspects of the writing life. Mm-hmm. And I had the support from my husband. My mother helped a lot, too. Some writing colonies, crucial. And once I had that time away, I've found that since I've had children that I can be much more efficient mm-hmm. when I'm away than I was on a daily level before I had children. Mm-hmm. So those were real challenges. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's a lot of research in the book too, that hopefully doesn't feel like research, but right. there's a lot in there. And I had to do a lot of studying
yeah.
about divorce law and Germany and many other things. Albany, all of these locations, a lot of them I'd never been to before.
Mm-hmm. Did you pick Albany for any particular reason?
I don't remember my reasoning. Mm-hmm. I just knew they were gonna go on a road trip. I do have a genuine love of New England
yeah.
that's developed over my many years. And I went not from here originally, mm-hmm. but I moved up here for college, and then I stayed here. And I, with a brief sojourn to the Midwest for grad school, came back here and feel really at home here. And one thing that was very influential, speaking of influences, was the beauty of the New England landscape, mm-hmm. you know? And I just thought, I hadn't been to Albany, but I had spent some time in Saratoga Springs. And I remembered Lake George, and I remembered all that, and I thought, oh, it's beautiful up there. And then there's all these mountains, the Adirondacks, the Berkshires, I mean, green, white, I mean, what mountains aren't there up here? And so I started to visualize him just going north, I also needed him to get close to Canada.
I was
right?
going to say, then you have borders also.
Yes,
you have Vermont, you have
exactly.
yeah, Canada as well.
That's I needed right. that to be, in some ways, his unconscious goal. Mm-hmm. And then I got in the car, and I drove around, and I realized, in some ways, I was both following him and creating him at the same time.
Yeah.
And I drove, went to Albany, spent a day or so there, kind of got enough of a sense of it, and this is where they, of course, live when they're happy, mm-hmm. when they're married and the meadow is happy with them. And then they take off and go to, of course, upstate New York, Vermont, New Hampshire, and finally Boston. I really enjoyed writing those places. Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about in what sense this is an immigrant story?
It may be a very specific kind of mm-hmm. immigrant story that is borrowed from my personal history. Mm-hmm. I think that it's more of an influence than I realize, that my mother left Latvia when she was just a child, and then there was this gap when she was in displaced persons camps before she came to the United States and was about 11. I mean, very similar in age, though. It was a totally different time period than as Eric, who arrives here, I think, when he's 9. What I remember from my mom talking about this was that, she was leaving World War II, which destroyed so many lives and so many cultures in a way, too. And she had left everything, a beautiful, idyllic childhood, but then a very rocky transition. Mm-hmm. And she arrived here with this heavy accent, and she was teased. And what a mix of emotions for a child to bear. Mm-hmm. You know, she should be grateful she made it here, mm-hmm. alive. As the Latvians were kind of persecuted by the invading Soviet army. And yet she wasn't happy here. Mm-hmm. And her parents weren't either, because they were not. They never really assimilated. My grandmother and grandfather never really learned English. Mm-hmm. I had a relationship with people I couldn't actually speak to, mm-hmm. you know, for a long time. I remember my tetas, he would say, "How is the poetry?" And this is all he could say. And I was like, "Great, it's great, thank you." "How is church?" my mother was in between identities, this Latvian identity that they tried to move here whole, and American identity, which was supposed to be nicer. So it brings up, I think, a lot of immigrants deal with feeling torn mm-hmm. between the old country and the new, not being sure which one they belong in, and finally feeling that they don't belong in either.
Right.
And Eric feels that way. I don't know if we've said yet to the listeners that he calls himself Eric Kennedy. Maybe we haven't said that. Yet his real name is Eric Schroeder. Eric Kennedy is a persona he chooses for himself in order to get into a boys' summer camp and become a different person during the summer times, mm-hmm. so that he can be, in essence, so that he can just be happier and not be a heavily accented immigrant, right?
Right.
With not a lot of money or prestige.
And also the Germany being split is another great mm-hmm. extra split, right?
Yeah.
There's the split between the old and the new, but and coming to America, but also Germany itself.
You know,
divided.
I contemplate, yes, absolutely. And I like that as a metaphor. I think for Europeans, and the book is coming out in Europe, and I did get one review where it was sort of like, well, we all know that. We know that metaphor. But I think for me as an American, it was a novel one.
Yeah.
I did contemplate giving him a different ethnicity other than German in some ways to differentiate it from the Clark Rockefeller story.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I'm glad I didn't, because I do like that metaphor mm-hmm. of the divided Germany and mm-hmm. the giving that extra layer of detachment, disassociation that he feels.
Yeah.
For me, it was. It could have been many other ethnic identities,
mm-hmm.
but I do choose that.
Yeah.
Do choose German identity,
mm-hmm.
and there's much more there for me to know or learn about what it really feels like to be from that country.
Right.
I mean, what a unique identity in this modern history.
And unique because you can smell the other side, right? Because it's so, in some ways, so close.
Yeah, it must be very. History must be extremely powerful in that country.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about Eric's mother? He says at one point, one of his biggest sources of anguish is not knowing whether or not she's still alive, right? And it's a his relationship with his mother is a little bit muted. Much of the novel is about his relationship with his father, with whom he came over. And there's a scene in which his father wants to tell him, is trying to tell him some things about his mother, but he cannot listen, right? He can't hear it. Can you just talk about that relationship a little bit?
The Eric and his dad.
And his mother.
And his mother, yeah. Okay. Sure, he leaves East Germany not without his mother. And that's pretty much all we know for most of the book. And eventually, you know, without giving too much away, I think it weighs on him more and more. And part of what we see that maybe he doesn't see is the impact of that mystery upon his life and his psyche. He avoids it and runs away from it. But we know that he can't. He can't run away from that because you can't run away from yourself. And perhaps I'm suggesting that part of why he's creating this identity is to run away from that pain. Mm-hmm. And I do think that that is why sometimes people pretend and fantasize to escape psychic pain. Mm-hmm.
And then I wanted to ask you also just a question about his research in silence.
Oh, sure.
we've been talking about dialogue in fiction and writing one, and about something that Anne Lamott writes, which is that, which I think is really crucial for writers to absorb, which is that what isn't said is what is as important as what is said in dialogue.
Yes, yes.
And for him, silence is actually a topic of research, right?
Yeah.
Causality. What made you, was that in the book from the beginning? Did you add it as it went? What made you think about
I knew that I wanted Eric to be at work on a manuscript. I don't know why. I think it's a type, and it's a type, the autodidact that I've always been sort of charmed by, the person who has esoteric scholarly interests, but not necessarily the learning or the discipline to really follow through. And that's Eric, right? He's got this emotional interest in silence, which we could analyze being many different kinds of silences in his life. The silence of his mother, the silence of his father.
His parents together.
Yeah, his parents together. Mm-hmm. The silences between he and his wife as their marriage is falling apart. And so he's trying to see them, and he's trying to study them as if somehow one could do that. So there's some amusing irony, at least for me, amusing, that he's trying to attempt one scholarly pursuit that's almost impossible, you know. And as he says, what I was trying to collect is completely undocumented. He's trying to collect these famous, notable pauses or silences, you know. I think I both admired his hubristic, I would say, desire to do that, and also find it, you know, sad. It's an impossible research project.
Yeah, it's great that it's a little grandiose. A little grandiose, a little impossible, a little stupid.
Don't you know somebody too, like an uncle or whomever, who has some crazy book they've been working on their whole lives? I feel like I know a lot of those people. And maybe I feel that way about myself sometimes, too.
Yeah.
The writer, you're never sure.
I know.
If what you're doing...
It just comes out of your head.
You're never sure if you're just delusional.
That's right. let's talk a little bit about just as much as you'd like to talk about the business end of writing a little bit. There's this moment where the piece of art you've been working on, investing in for years, confronts the market, right? It confronts a whole world of agents, publishers, editors, marketing people. How much of the marketplace is in your mind as you write these days? And did anything surprise you about the way the marketplace greeted your book, the way it came into the market?
Yes. I think that Schroeder has more what I like to call profluence, or kind of a dynamic narrative than my first two works. Mm-hmm. But I didn't set out with that in mind. That happened felicitously, we shall say, you know, and I'm glad about that. But no, I didn't intend for it to be what a couple people have said, a breakout book, or is this your breakout book? You know, like, if you set out to write your breakout book, I think you're going to do the opposite, don't you?
Yeah,
you're
going to
break in book. So I didn't think of that. Because I think you do have to shut that out, hard as it is, while you're writing. But now, talking about as much as I am and being so conscious of trying to become conscious of what I was doing, or see it now with some distance, I think that there was certainly the hope that people would engage with him and engage with me, and I knew that there were some risks I was taking too, because he is a dad kidnapping a girl, and I didn't want people to be frightened by that. I didn't want him to seem like a monster or an abuser, and he's not, but I know that there's the scariness of that. But I wanted to go there. I do believe, I mean, I was very close with my father, and he really helped me very much as a writer, and was kind of my coach and teacher in the way that Eric is a little with Meadow. So there was part of that as my homage to, in some ways, a healthy father-daughter relationship. But I knew that there's a lot of assumptions around that. And fortunately, I ended up finding an editor who went there with me, and he, from the get-go, his name's Kerry Goldstein, he's the editor of and publisher of 12 Books, which is an imprint of Hachette Books. He just read the book, responded enthusiastically. He wrote an email to my agent saying, I cried twice reading this book, not with like sadness, I think with like fear and some bittersweetness, but He just, I feel very grateful and respected by him that he took a book that is, it takes some risks. It certainly takes some risks with content. It also takes some risks formally, and just supported it. And I could not imagine a better publishing experience. I talk to Kerry and to Brian, my publicist, almost every day. And we're texting and emailing, and mostly because there's out of necessity. There's, like, fortunately, things to do. And they came out with, they sort of publicized the book before it even came out by just reaching out to booksellers in a way I hadn't seen before. So I was meeting booksellers, mostly of independent bookshops, because that's the structure these days. Then there's not that many chains left, really. And trying to get them to read my book, and to separate it from the huge pile of other books that they have to read. And that helped. And Kerry also and Brian, very deliberate about getting the book to certain newspapers or reviewers and giving them a kind of personal introduction to it. All of these ways in which they carefully and kind of creatively tried to get people to read it. And what they found, what they tell me, is that there was, you know, a response, and maybe partially because they got them to the right people, but it wasn't met with indifference, let's say. You know, people had strong feelings about it. And I think that that gave them an indication that, oh, well, at the very least, like, this book is a good one to discuss, you know. And so I'm certainly hoping that book clubs take it on. I think it's a great book for, certainly, and book clubs are often women, but there's certainly co-ed book clubs, and I've even been to an all-men book club or two, and it's a really good book to use as a discussion, to jump off from in terms of discussion, like parenting, immigration, identity, marriage, things like that. I have found that the people do have, the readers I've come into contact with have a lot of to say and strong feelings. And I think that's good. I'm glad about that.
Mm-hmm. thank you for discussing this novel again. I know that you're doing that as a full-time job these days, talking about
No complaints.
And so, and I know you've been up since 4 this morning as well.
That's
so
correct.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. I truly enjoyed talking to you.
I'm glad.
Thank you for talking to me.